possibly sit closer because I will be having notes in the margins, so if you can see them, great, but it might be helpful. And I will not mind if you want to move your seat while I'm speaking. It is a pleasure immensely to be here. Thank you, especially to Rob, who invited me. But also, I've had such interesting conversations in the last 2 days, more than typically a month's worth. And for that, I'm very grateful to those of you whom I've spoken with. I'd like to take this opportunity to talk about earlier work from about 2 years ago that I did relating to Cyrilson inequalities, because I think it's most relevant for this crowd. And the idea here is, I could just say, go read the paper, but I hope to give a couple of examples, not in the paper, and I hope to illustrate and clean up some of the logic behind it, fill in the details, provide a more personal, detailed walkthrough so that you could actually do it yourself, reproduce the results, kind of thing. So let me address the question here. What we're trying to do is we're going to ask, how does one obtain a Cyrilson bound? Now, a Cyrilson bound essentially says there's some experiment, and we're going to consider parties having various things that they can measure, and then we could write down some function of the probabilities. It's a sum of various probabilities that could happen. Joint, marginal, same, different. So one that you could ask is, take these four probabilities, the probability that if Alice is doing experiment zero and Bob's doing zero, they get the same. Add to that the probability that if Alice is doing zero, she gets the same as whatever Bob got in one. Add to that the probability that if Alice is doing experiment number one for her, she gets the same as Bob zero, and then subtract the remaining of the four combinations. And you end up with something which is pretty well known, that if you ask in quantum mechanics what is the largest you could ever see on that sum, it's 2 plus the square root of 2. It's written in terms of probabilities. And that's different from what local hidden variable models would give, and that's different from what any general sort of probabilistic theory which respects no signaling would give. And so it's this 2 plus 2 kind of thing that we're going to focus in on and not ask where does that one come from specifically, but more general. But before we do so, we're going to leave this language of probabilities. And we're going to work in expectation values. This is convenience. This is convention. It's nothing to be upset about. Expectation values I'm going to put in like the sort of brackets. And it's we're talking about plus and minus one things which can be observed. So therefore, the expectation value of, say, Alice doing experiment I would be you take the positive probability with value 1, and you add to it the probability of the negative output with a minus sign in front. And so when you average, that's your sort of expectation value. And you can do the same thing with, well, that's a typo. It should be the probability of minus 1 in the red. But you can ask also about the probability of them being the same, right? And because the outputs that we're considering are plus and minus 1, so then plus 1 times plus 1 is 1, minus 1 times minus 1 is also plus 1. So we're talking about the probability of the product being 1. And we can write this as an expectation value. And so to go from probabilities to expectation values, the short of it is, well, I'm going to actually give you the reverse recipe, which is that an expectation value, which could range from negative 1 to 1, you would add 1 and then divide by 2. All right, and so restated like so, we get the usual form that Cyrilson bounds are given in. And so it's the sort of expected value of correlation, and so on and so on and so forth, minus, and you get your 2 root 2. Yes? Same page? Good. So this is the question now, which we're going to turn attention to, which is, in general, for not just the famous cases, but any case where somebody writes down an arbitrary combination, whether it involves just them being the same or also possibly just marginals, and we want to find the quantum bound for an arbitrary linear inequality. That's our goal here. Now, why do we want to do this? Why is it important to be able to answer the question, for any linear inequality, give the quantum bound? Well, because this will provide a characterization of the quantum elliptope, which is what we're after. The quantum elliptic of correlations basically says if you have a scenario, let's take the CHSH scenario, we'll eliminate that for now. There are various possible probability distributions. Some of them can happen in quantum mechanics, some of them can't. We'd like to know which probability distributions can happen in quantum mechanics, right? To characterize all possible probability distributions. Now, a linear inequality doesn't by itself answer that question. It doesn't say, is this point quantum allowable? Because I'm not actually specifying any of the parameters. But it's still valuable. The idea is that if we take just if we allow the marginal probabilities to be completely uniform and random, so basically the expectation values are zero on the marginals, with that, it's possible to completely characterize the quantum correlations. So if you're given four expectation values for the four correlations, it's been solved, there's an equation, you plug it in, this is it, it's been solved in 87, 88, and 03 independently, Tsiros and Landau and Massanas, different forms, and you take the inverse sine of these functions, you sum them, plus, 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 minus, take the absolute value, should be less than pi. If that's true, it's quantum compatible. If it's not true, it's not quantum compatible. And this is the kind of wonderful result that it's really useful to have. Is a statistic quantum compatible or not? But it's only been done completely in the four-dimensional problem for CHSH. When we get to eight dimensions, and it is an eight-dimensional problem, even for CHSH, it's kind of an open problem. Now, there is an NPA hierarchy, and we're going to come back to that, which says, okay, suppose you have a given point. I'm going to tell you semi-dependent programming. Here's how you can determine it one way or another. And you can run it through, and you're going to get a yes or no answer. But it's not a characterization of the elliptope in the sense that you can't just sort of like have some function of the eight parameters, even nonlinear, and just say if it respects this, yes, if it doesn't respect it, no. Right.
Is this a way of talking about the number of settings, the number of outcomes, or?
No, this is talking about the number of parameters needed to describe the joint probability distribution. So in just a moment, next slide, I will explain why the joint probability distribution of two parties with two outputs, which you would think is 16 possible joint probabilities, is in fact described with only eight parameters. Any joint probability distribution can be described in terms of eight parameters, but it's an eight-dimensional problem. If you then impose further that the marginals are uniform, you're still left with four parameters. And so here's the idea. The idea is that using a Tsiros-Sinn inequality, if we get a lot of them, right? Let's say all of them, I don't know, then we can, each one creates sort of a surface and says, that your quantum correlations have to be on this side of the inequality, this side of the inequality, this side. And so the more of them you have, the tighter you start carving this space, right? And so even though facets make a polytope, and the quantum correlation set is an elliptope, not a polytope, a bunch of them will start making something which looks awfully curvy. And so the idea is, all right, let's go with linear inequalities. If we have enough of them, it'll be good enough. And then I'll surprise you, because we can actually do better than that. But okay. So to Rob's question, why am I saying that it's an eight-dimensional problem? So these are the 16 joint probabilities which would describe everything, which is a probability of, of in green being success, red being failure, right? So you have this box here, which is when they're both doing the 0-0 experiment. Then they could both succeed, one could succeed, they could both fail. And you have the situation where Alice is doing experiment one, Bob is doing experiment two, right? And so these are the 16 joint probabilities which would describe the experiment. The claim here is that only eight really matter. So first off, you'll note that in any situation where we're talking about them doing the same settings, right? Say each of these four corners on the side, normalization requires them to sum to one. So I could take these three and treat them as independent, and then just say this one is one minus those. So it's not really a free parameter. And then we have no signaling. No signaling tells us that we have a concept of a marginal probability at all. So we can talk about what's the probability of Alice succeeding when she does experiment zero, just Alice, right? So then to answer that, you would sum over all the different ways that it could happen for Bob, because we're only interested in how it would happen for Alice. So we can take Alice when Bob succeeds and Alice when Bob fails, and this is Alice zero. But you can write it this way, or you could write it with this sum, which is the sum of Bob's success and failure probabilities when Bob is doing a different experiment, because they're the same, because Alice's marginal probability has nothing to do, it's independent, you get the same result both ways. And so if I say that this sum is equal to this sum, then I can take this last parameter and make it simply these two minus that one. And so it's another one which gets dropped. And so you can talk about dropping a parameter because of the notion of a marginal probability for Alice succeeding in experiment zero. Similarly, you can drop another parameter for Alice succeeding in experiment one. You can drop a parameter because you can talk about the marginal probabilities for Bob succeeding in one or for Bob succeeding in two. And so there's where you drop your other four. And that's why it takes it down essentially to an eight-dimensional problem. In other words, with these eight values for marginal probabilities and for probabilities of getting the same result, it's possible to reconstruct the 16. So it's an eight-dimensional problem. And so I think it's an interesting question, how big is it in general? If you have k parties, m settings per party, and then every setting could have d outputs, respecting no signaling, what's the number of core parameters? And I'm pretty sure it's this. If someone is aware of a reference, I would be interested. This is a derivation I pulled off last night. I'm kind of confident, but it's got to have been done before. All right, so let's answer the question. We're considering an arbitrary linear inequality, which is made up of these sort of eight primary parameters, the same in the different experiments and the different marginals. And we want to get the quantum limit for an arbitrary linear inequality. All right, where would we start? Well, we would start with the literature. It appears to have been solved already in the original paper, which gave the 2 root 2, which is generalizations of Bell's inequality from Jurlson. And he gives theorem 2, which is fantastic. Basically, he treats this exact problem with eight parameters. And I have these as arbitrary weighting constants. He says, you got your here, 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 and then there's a function, you plug them in, and it's it'll tell you the quantum bound. Right? And so then if we take the first four to be zero, and then 1, 1, 1, negative 1, you get your 2 root 2. So, fantastic. Let me just look it up, and then I will get a collection of linear inequalities, a couple hundred of them, we'll call it a characterization of the quantum elliptic. So, problem was, I went to the equation in the paper, and I couldn't make it work. The way I understood it, the way I was reading it, if I would try putting in the well-known results, like the 1, 1, 1, negative 1, and following the theorem, it came out to something other than 2 root 2. And if I put in everything 0 except for just one parameter, and I made that 1, so I would expect to get a maximum quantum value of 1, right? What's the maximum probability or maximum expected value of A0? It should be limited by 1, right? Just a trivial question. And it ended up that in my calculations, using the theorem, I was getting something like a half. So I felt like I was failing. And this was the first research project I was doing as a grad student. So I was like, all right, I just suck at this. And I wrote to Dr. Jurlson, who thankfully is alive and well, in response to email. And I said, I'm working through your paper. Clearly, I'm not getting something. Can you help me out? So he wrote back. And ooh, is it an interesting response. So first he says, yeah, it's not going to work. Then he says, also, there is no proof. And no one has the calculations anymore for how the proof was done. Right? And I'm not going to go back to it. And then he had this personal note, which was really sad, which is that he was able to get this paper out in 1980, which contained all these wonderful theorems and results, with the intention of following it up with a much longer paper proving all the theorems and the results. But he never published the proof paper, because no one would take it. All the journals were being anti-Semitic. because he was trying to apply for Aliyah, was a refusenik thing in the Soviet Union, and so he explains they weren't going to let him publish anything. Also, especially interesting for the Rumor Institute, he says no one was interested. And apparently quotes one of his reviewers as saying that his whole topic is strange, it's not mathematics or physics, and it's of very little interest. And so that was the end of that. So he says, go find the error and fix it. All right. So we corresponded a bit further, and I was able to see where he comes from, and now I will share with you the idea which was never proven in 1980. Here we go. You treat the local quantum measurements as quantum operators, and we only define the local quantum measurements. So we give a quantum operator to describe A0 and A1 and B0 and B1, and then we treat any joint observation as a composed operation. And this, by the way, is why we love expectation values, because if we're talking about +1 and -1 eigenvalued on the local observables, then we can talk about their probability of being the same is the product of the two. Right? If we were just doing this with projective measurements, it would be much more frustrating, because we would have to talk about we'd have to sum over different projective measurements, the probability of them both getting a 1 and the probability of them both getting a 0, which would introduce more terms. But here it's just the multiplication, which is very nice. And for qubits, we need to have operators which have +1 or -1 eigenvalues. So we're going to be drawing upon the Pauli matrices, because they're very useful for this. The different parties have to have commuting measurements. So the way we're going to deal with that is we're going to put the measurements in different Hilbert spaces. That'll make them commute. In general, that might not be the best idea. But for 2 qubits and for the CHSH scenario, it's fine. And the last thing I'm going to mention is that in these dichotomic scenarios where we're talking about 2 measurements per party and not more than that, then 1 degree of freedom is sufficient. And by degree of freedom, I mean we're going to treat these quantum operators here as fully general so that we can maximize over all quantum possibilities. But we don't need to generalize with more than 1 degree of freedom per party, because it's the difference between the 2 operators that matter. So the basis that it's most convenient to work with is to choose sigma x and sigma y. But you don't have to do that. You can choose sigma y, sigma z, sigma x, sigma z, any 2. And then the idea is you have 1 observable, and then you have another observable, and they are different. And they can be different by a lot or by a little. So you can, if you wanted to, set A0 as sigma z, and then A1 is something which is deviating towards sigma x from sigma z. The setup that I'm going to use here is sigma x and sigma y. And so there's this angle, and I'll impose a reflection symmetry. So I'll take A0 to bend up towards y, and I'll take A1 to bend down towards y, and similarly for Bob. And this is particularly nice because sigma x and sigma y have zeros along the diagonal, and then they just become complex conjugates when you sum them. But it's not necessary. Okay. So now let me explain. Yes?
Are you assuming that both A and B are measuring in the xy plane?
Yes, but their xy planes are only locally defined, as in, who's to say that Bob's x is the same as Alice's x? In other words, you could do a unitary transform which would rotate you any way you want. And because we're not going to actually specify a state, it's arbitrary. If we specified a state, that would be more of a concern. But this is, so this is what we're saying needs to be done. You take your linear inequality, and we translate it now into quantum observables, which have these sort of degrees of freedom so that they're able to represent the full extent of what any quantum observer would be. And so now you compose and you treat the linear equality as some sort of quantum operator, because it's a sum of these different things with weights. And so now we want to say, OK, I have this quantum operator, which presumably I could trace with some state to get the probability of this inequality. And I want to maximize this to see how big I can get the quantum regime to be. Okay, so at this point, having composed this sort of thing with all the weights, taking into account whatever they are, I'm going to have some matrix, right, in terms of the Pauli matrices tensor product with the weights. So with the matrix, I would then write down its characteristic polynomial because I want to get the eigenvalues. Now, the eigenvalues, the largest eigenvalue is what we're really after here, right? Because for any state, this observable, the most you're ever going to get out of it is its largest eigenvalue. Or you can get some mixture of the eigenvalues, but the best possible thing you do is get the largest eigenvalue, right? So this is state independent. All we have to do is see how big we can get the largest eigenvalue to be. So we want to take the eigenvalues here, and we want to find the biggest one. So in our case, we're talking about a 4x4 matrix. It's a quartic polynomial, so we would solve for four roots, and the roots of the polynomial are going to have theta A and theta B sort of built in, right? And so technically, we then need to do maximization, where we need to say, let me consider all the possible scenarios. So Alice is measuring similarly or differently, similarly for Bob, and then what's going to be the best thing that they can do in quantum mechanics. And if we see how large we can make the largest root be under variation of theta A and theta B, that's the quantum bound. Right? So that's the setup, that's the idea. There's a problem, though. The problem is in practice. First off, already here, just for two qubits, I have mentioned that we have to solve the roots of a polynomial. And this is not a numeric polynomial because I haven't even specified for theta A and theta B, which I'm going to be doing the maximization over. So for higher dimensional systems, good luck solving all the roots of your polynomial. And then what we're talking about is maximization of the largest root of the polynomial over multiple degrees of freedom. So it's a simultaneous maximization problem. For multiple parties, it would be multiple parameters. So this is not going to make life easy. In principle, it's fine. And I can say this is how you do it, maximize the largest eigenvalue. But that's a really hard thing to do. However, this is not a regular polynomial. And there's a secret sauce here. And this part I'm going to go for the next 5 minutes is simple but true and worth stating because it almost never gets discussed and it provides a tremendous advantage. The advantage here is the polynomial, the characteristic polynomial that we're talking about, is a hyperbolic polynomial. In other words, we're guaranteed all real roots. Why? Because it's a Hermitian operator. Hermitian operators have all real roots. The fact that all the roots of the polynomial are real changes everything. It means that we don't have to solve for the roots and maximize the largest one. We have a whole different approach coming from the intermediate value theorem. So let me explain why this is a major advantage. Take any polynomial, right? This is sort of a random quartic polynomial. And leading coefficient 1, because you can always make leading coefficient 1 if we're just interested in identifying the roots, right? And so it has, in this case, four real roots. Why am I calling this the intermediate value theorem? Because, well, first off, something that's obvious is that the derivative, the sign of the derivative, alternates between roots, right? So here the polynomial is going down, here it's coming up, going down, coming up, right? This is a simple, Tobias, you're frowning?
Well, if you don't have degeneracy, I guess. If you have a degenerate operator with just several eigenvalues,
the same. So then they would be sort of like, yes.
You might have a parabolic neighborhood of this series.
Yep, that's fine. So let's go with that. So if you have a degenerate root, so then what you would see is that the you would have a the derivative at the root would be zero, and the derivative at the next root, who knows what it could be, but it would therefore certainly not be zero. So you would still, well, I guess it could be zero. Yes, okay. The derivative at the two roots could also be zero, even under degeneracy. But here's something that's definitely true, which is that in between two roots, if they are separated, you're going to have a critical point. Because even in the case where you have a degeneracy, right? So this is not a degeneracy case. So the degeneracy case would be so you come down, and then you sort of brush against the axis, and you come up, and then you come back down. Nonetheless, you're going to need to turn around, right? So at some point between any two roots, between any two real roots, you have to have a critical point, which is to say that the derivative is zero, right? So the statement here is nothing fancy. If we have four real roots or degenerate roots, in which case at the degenerate roots you have a zero of the derivative, but in between the roots you will have zero derivative. And so a degenerate root is basically two roots coinciding, and in between them or at them is a root. So now we're guaranteed that these are all real. And so now the same thing holds true for the second derivative, which is if I have a root of the first derivative, in between them has to be roots of the second derivative, of which there are two for a quartic. Right? And in between these two has to be a root of the third derivative. Right? Nothing fancy. This is like eighth grade. We're learning about polynomials. But what this tells me is that if I have all real roots, if I have the promise of all real roots, then all the changes happen in between the largest and the smallest. And by changes, I mean changes in the sign of the polynomial, changes in the sign of its derivative, changes in the sign of the second, third derivative, and so on and so forth. What that means is that if I look here to the right of the largest root, I can say that in this region, the function is positive, and it has positive first derivative, positive second derivative, positive third derivative, and so on and so forth. And I can guarantee that that property holds true everywhere to the right of the largest root, and that it holds true up until the largest root. So it completely defines this region. The reason I can do this is I can say, well, way out in infinity, right, as any polynomial approaches infinity with leading coefficient 1, it becomes infinite, and its first derivative becomes infinite, and second derivative becomes infinite, and so on and so forth, until the derivatives cease being, and then you just get a constant, right? And so if at infinity everything is positive, it can't change, because all the changes of the polynomial and of its derivatives have to take place in between the two roots. This is only true if we're guaranteed all real roots, right? If I take this, these sort of two, and I raise it so that I have these two roots and then some sort of like dip down here, then I would have a whole bunch of changes going on in the first and second derivatives before I would hit the largest root. But if I have four real roots, then I can say that the value of everything and the limit towards infinity is the value all the way up until the largest root. This is huge! This changes everything. Because now, instead of doing a solving for the roots and then performing maximization over the degrees of freedom, theta A and theta B, I can simply write down a bunch of positivity conditions which define the region where we are to the right of the largest root. And then I can minimize the value of the polynomial subject to the positivity conditions until I coincide with the largest root. And I can minimize the value of this sort of the x-axis parameter respecting these constraints, but I have to be able to minimize it for all theta A and theta B, for the worst case scenario, in order to find the quantum scenario, because the largest root may change depending on what theta A and theta B is. And so if I say that you're positive for it and its derivatives and so on and so forth, no matter what theta A and theta B are, the smallest I can get there is the largest quantum bound. So what we're doing is we're reformulating, instead of having a simultaneous maximization, we're doing a single variable minimization, but with a whole bunch of constraints, and the constraints are written in terms of for all statements. Let me explain this in a bit more detail. And this holds for any Hermitian eigenvalue problem. So forget that we're talking about the CHS scenario and finding quantum bounds. I mean, we've all had to maximize eigenvalues for one reason or another. And whenever you're having a Hermitian situation and you want to find maximization of the eigenvalue, you can take advantage of exactly this. So I wanted to stress that point. All right, so let's work through one together to illustrate the point. Here's a linear bound that we're interested in, right? It's the CHSH, but we tack on an A0, right? A marginal probability. What's the quantum bound? So the idea is, first, we take this and we express it as a operator, so you get your matrix, right? And it ends up looking something which is sort of block anti-diagonal, but the specific form isn't important. What's important is getting the characteristic polynomial, which I don't have to solve, but I need to have it and all its derivatives positive. So I get these four conditions: the characteristic polynomial and its three derivatives are all positive, and they're positive over all theta A and theta B. And now I'm saying, what's the smallest m I can choose to make which satisfies these four constraints? That for all theta A and theta B, these four constraints hold true. What's the smallest m? If I can answer that question, I get the quantum bound. All right, so let me actually walk you through this one. The fact that I have m positive means that I can take m cubed minus 5m and write that as saying that m squared is greater than 5. Right? Here, I would say that m squared is greater than 5/3. So this one, greater than 5, is more important than greater than 5/3. I can just go ahead and erase this, because this is stronger. And then for that matter, what I'm basically saying is if m squared is greater than 5, I can drop the m by expressing that as a square root. So m has to be bigger than the square root of 5. Right? So I can effectively just condense these last three into just m greater than the square root of 5. Right? But I still have the statement here about for all theta A and theta B, m has to be respecting this. So I'm not sure where that's going to take me, but we'll find out. First idea is, I've now written this as the polynomial is greater than this term, because that had a minus sign out front. So if the polynomial is greater than this, and I want to impose that I want to make this as hard as possible for m, right? I want to force the polynomial to be big. So then I want to make this as big as possible. So clearly I don't want to choose anything too small. I have a cosine squared sine squared. What's the biggest I can make of the product of a cosine squared sine squared? Well, that's done by taking them both to be 1 over root 2, which takes this business, the 64, to 16, and condenses it down. Yes? Any questions at this point? What we're doing, again, to stress here, is we want to make this condition written as strong as possible. So m, or m cubed, has to be greater than as the worst possible case scenario. And then I can say, well, if I can get m this small, where it still respects all that, that's going to be the quantum bound. So that's going to be the first step. And then I now want to maximize over this. So I would rewrite sine as 1 minus cosine squared. Sine squared is 1 minus cosine squared. And then it's pretty easy to take the derivative with respect to cosine squared. And I find that cosine squared is maximized if I choose it to be 5/8. And so this whole term here, the 16, again, sorry, typo, becomes 9. And walking that through, that means that the worst case scenario, maximizing over theta A and theta B, tells me that this holds true. Note that I still never, ever tried to solve for the roots of the polynomial, which is part of the joy here. So now I have this equation, or this condition and this condition, and I need to see what's the smallest m which respects both. Well, this condition here simplifies a great deal, and so I get an m squared greater than 10, and an m greater than the square root of 5. So that tells me, this is the more important one, subject to positivity, this is the limit, square root of 10. Right? Not that hard to get, taking advantage of the fact that it's a hyperbolic polynomial because it's a Hermitian operator. Now, this square root of 10 is not just an example that I've sort of picked because it was particularly easy to get to, but it's kind of non-trivial. It's really important. You can rule out a lot of statistics with this one, which even the TLM bound, which is a complete characterization in the four-dimensional space, won't catch, because this is now, you know, a real marginal involving linear inequality. So let's put this in context. some quantum bounds to consider are this one here, which is the one that we just derived completely, your 3 root 10 and 4. So quantum has root 10, which is it's a little bit bigger than root 9, so it's a little bit bigger than 3. So it's between 3 and 4. And that's, you know, fits the pattern of it exceeds the local bound, but doesn't quite get up to no signaling. Here's another interesting one. This is my favorite, if I'm allowed to have favorites. And that's with the 1, 1, minus 1 on the marginals and then CSH left over, you end up finding something that looks like this, that the quantum bound is 3. But interestingly here, the local bound is 3. This is kind of interesting, right? When I saw this, it kind of reminded me of Hardy non-locality, in the sense that if we saw any, it would be the inverse, right? Because here, if we saw anything which would violate the local hidden variable model, that would be a problem for quantum mechanics. Any non-locality at all would be non-quantum, which is, I think, really neat. These just sort of come a dime a dozen. I'm going to numerically demonstrate that this is a particularly valuable one also, but I think it's really interesting. Okay.
Do the local and the no signaling bounds stay the same regardless of what marginals you attach?
No, they don't. But the reason they change here is, so in CHSH it's 2 and 4, right? And then sort of you're adding 1, so you can sort of see where your LHVM would just increase because the Bell inequalities don't make any reference to this. So you could put them up to 1. The shorter answer is, generally speaking, no. So the way, let's just say that it so happens to be here. If you want to extend a linear inequality for which you solve the quantum case, and you want to go back and say, well, now let me get the local and no signaling case, it's a different story, possibly worth a different seminar. But the short of it is, you take the no signaling constraints by themselves, which are constraints on the 8 parameters, and then you say, what's the maximum over the actual 8 parameters themselves that you could get? And then you could restrict to that plus the Bell inequalities. But in general, no. In general, they change. Okay. Now, we get a bonus. The bonus is that not only do we get numeric or linear inequalities if we wanted to, where we can start considering, you know, this plus that plus the other, but the technique is completely analytic by nature. There's nothing in which involves there's no reason why we can't put in undefined weights and then solve for the limit. So we could do this in detail if you want, but I consider here, instead of just putting a 1 in front, let's put x in front, right? And so instead of getting square root of 3, you find that it actually takes the form 2x squared plus 8 squared. And so, of course, you try 1, that's just 2 plus 8 squared root of 10, and then 3 and 4. And then here, if we do x, x, and minus x instead of 1, we can get a new quantum bound. And here, it illustrates something really interesting. Because here, by the way, this only applies if x is less than 2. But here, we see something which is kind of interesting. Here, if x is equal to or greater than 1, then the quantum bound coincides with a local bound. And it's not the same as the no signaling bound. But if x is less than 1, then you get a quantum bound which exceeds the local bound. So you have this sort of region here where for different parameters of x, you will see quantum non-locality, and then you don't see any quantum non-locality, even though there's the possibility of quantum non-locality, and then if you let x go even higher, there ends up being no difference between no signaling and local, and everything converges. But looks like there's some new physics here. All right. Now, subtle point. I call these nonlinear quantum bounds, and I'm saying that today, but uh, in the in the way we published it, we called them function-valued linear quantum bounds. The reason being is I've had a change of heart and perspective on what you can do with this. Because, okay, it's a linear bound with an x, but you can take this and make it nonlinear by saying, all right, for all x less than 2, this is true. And then you can get a, you can refine that condition, and you get a very nonlinear restraint, constraint. Which I should say is really valuable, because remember, the motivation here is that we're trying to characterize the quantum elliptope, which is a curved surface. And so, of course, we can do that if all we have are facets, right, which are linear inequalities. But if we get nonlinear inequalities, we can actually take curves to approximate the elliptic and do a really, really, really good job. So with these two, just these two and their implied symmetries, we get a very, very, very good approximation for the eight-dimensional quantum elliptic. Let me explain. So take this one, which is the one which had the limit of 3, right? Let's call it QB3. First level of the NPA criterion says that if you were to sum these nonlinear functions, inverse sine of so on and so forth, you're restricted to less than pi. Right? So here's a linear bound, and here's the NPA first level criterion. Here's a test point where we have marginals which are biased. So Alice, if she does 0 or 1, she tends to see a positive result. So their expected value is 1/3, right? And we'll request that the correlations also be observed. So we'll let Bob's marginal be uniform, and we'll treat these as 2/3, right? And so in the quantum limit, these can go up until like 85% or so. So we're not imposing too much. We're adding a little bit on the marginal and relaxing the correlations to be 66%. Is this quantum? Well, according to this criterion, sure. But according to this much, much simpler criterion, no, it's not. So this is me trying to illustrate the point that don't underestimate the value of a linear inequality. These are not like a legacy used in the 1980s and then should be forgotten. No, no, they are very, very powerful. They can answer questions like, is this point quantum or not? Which is, of course, the question at the end of the day that everyone always wants to ask, is this point quantum or not? So these help. I make some references to additional papers. Information causality. Ah, that was a good time. So this is a chart from the information causality paper where they were saying that you can kind of recover the quantum boundary from information causality, right? So you got your Chittleston bound from information causality. And this is in PRA. And so they consider various various statistics, various sets of the eight parameters, and they say, what's the quantum limit and what's the limit that comes from information causality, right? This is exactly the question that we're interested in for the quantum side, not the information causality side, which is, how do you characterize the eight-dimensional quantum elliptope? Now, their question was, does information causality characterize the eight-dimensional quantum elliptope? Problem being, there is no characterization of the eight-dimensional quantum elliptope. It motivated us to go out and collect Chittleston bounds. So I was like, oh, okay, sure, I'm interested in information causality, and they're comparing it to the quantum bound. What quantum bound? So I read the paper, I was all happy with it, I said it's a good paper, and then I had to go back and say, wait a second, they said that they're comparing the results to the quantum bound. Where did they get their quantum boundary from? And so there's a footnote, oh, they're using the first level of the NPA hierarchy as a stand-in for the quantum bound. And they can't use more than the first level, because more than the first level would require you to actually go and test a point iteratively, and they're trying to create a whole boundary, so they want to have some closed equation to graph against. So this is the one that they're using, which, by the way, is exactly the same as the conditions for macroscopic locality and so on and so forth. And they make this graph, and they show that information causality is, in fact, not exactly the same as quantum mechanics in the best formulation that they had at that time. That's essentially NPA1. They don't call it NPA1, they just call it QM. So as if NPA1 was all there was to QM.
So the QM thing would be below the red cone, right?
Yes.
In general?
It's tighter.
Okay.
Right? So I said, this is an interesting case to revisit with a Tsurlson bound, right? Say QB3. And there's a scene difference. It's across this entire facet. You can regenerate the graph. And with a linear inequality, you get a tighter characterization of QM, right? So this is a kind of a take-home message here. If we're working in quantum foundations and you have a principle, say local orthogonality, and you want to test, does it match against QM? You don't always have to take NPA1, which is sort of the gold standard. There are simple linear inequalities which have as much power, if not more. So here's an interesting question. This one is another paper that we can extend with linear inequalities. This, for me, was the original motivation for wanting to find out how to do this. And this question is, how much larger are quantum correlations than classical ones? So basically, there is a quantum elliptope, but in the same dimension, there is a local polytope and a no-signaling polytope, right? And the no-signaling polytope is sort of out the biggest, and then all quantum sets are inside there, but not all no-signaling are inside quantum, and then all local are inside quantum, but not, right? So you have sort of like a boxy shape, and then a curvy thing, and then another boxy shape, all embedded in eight dimensions. And the question then becomes, in general, if we were just looking at sort of random probability distributions, if you wanted to think about it like that, throw a dart, make up a set of statistics, is it quantum or not? Is it no signaling or not? Is it local or not? Right? And it's a simple question, but it's valuable in the sense that we all say, oh, quantum mechanics is non-local, quantum mechanics is non-local. But what if, in fact, there were only some instances where quantum mechanics was non-local, but in fact, you would find that when you look at things, almost always you can't tell the difference between quantum and local, and you really have to come up with sort of a sort of convoluted small fraction of probabilities where you see non-locality, right? This is asked by Adan Cabello, 2005 PRA, and so to answer the question requires that you have a characterization of statistics, which doesn't exist in eight dimensions. So he went ahead and answered the question in four dimensions. And he took the TLM criterion, Tsurlson-Landau-Mazanis, which is necessary and sufficient, and he answered it. And so setting no signaling as your sort of unit one, because in just the four-dimensional subspace, seeing four correlations are always possible, then the quantum mechanical set is 92%, and LHVM is 96%. And so you got an interesting question. All right. It's an interest piece, right? But now we can answer it for the eight-dimensional. Let's. So for the eight-dimensional quantum polytope, these are all fractional sort of relative numbers because just normalization and no signaling are going to mean that most eight numbers that you throw out are just nonsensical. So It's the relative ones that matter. These are all measured like 2 to the 8 over 8 factorial. So you got your 1088 for no signaling and 1084 for quantum mechanics. And this is an upper bound, right? Because all the linear inequalities that we're talking about, if they are satisfied, then that doesn't mean the point necessarily is quantum compatible. It just means that they reject. The points that they reject are definitely not quantum compatible. So any collection of facets to bound the elliptope will necessarily overestimate sort of the gaps between the curves and the facets. So this is an overestimate, but it's pretty close. I mean, it's hard to formally say what the correct answer is, but the idea is when you start putting in more and more and more facets and the number stops changing, you kind of have a sense that you're onto something. And so just for another point of contrast, here's the value that comes from NPA and LHVM. And so you can see that using the local bounds rejects twice as many probability points as the NPA criterion. That gets you to 1086. The linear inequalities get you to 1084. So while I don't necessarily think that this is worth you know, writing home about the fact that there are some numbers here, because the numbers are kind of arbitrary. What they do illustrate is that linear bounds are very valuable, practically speaking, at least in this sense. The two that I listed combined have twice the rejective power than NPA1. All right. So I, at this point, was prepared to summarize. But if we don't have pressing questions, then I have the idea that maybe we would derive one of these nonlinear inequalities, where you can sort of see how the different values of x lead to restrictions on the quantum maximum. But let me summarize anyway. So at this point, what I've said is that quantum linear inequalities, just the linear inequalities, are once again state of the art. They used to be, then we had a lot of other stuff coming around, NPA, Ufings bounds, TLM. But now that we can go back and talk about marginal involving quantum bounds, or quantum bounds which are have sort of functions in the weights, then these linear inequalities are leaving out hierarchies, the strongest tools we've got to characterize quantum correlations. I would also emphasize that the inequalities are readily derived. So I've given a few. You can look up others in the paper. But the method, you can do yourself. And this notion of, OK, if it's an eigenvalue maximization problem for a Hermitian matrix, don't forget that the intermediate values theorem gives you this wonderful tool, which says you don't actually have to solve for any roots. You can recast it as single variable constrained optimization. And this particular quantum bound is the one that seems to reject the most marginal involving points relative to NPA1. So just remember, 1 plus 1 minus 1, NCSH is less than 3. OK. I don't know if we're strict about topics. So Rob, let me ask you, should I go on to the separability stuff? Stay on this? We got 5 minutes to 4:30.
We've got about 10 minutes because we started late.
Oh, yeah? All right. So in 10 minutes, with permission, I will jump gears and talk a little bit about separability in symmetric states, which was another interest. And so this sort of second bit, I'm going to go into much, much, much less detail. But I think that there are some ideas which are sort of non-intuitive and I think worth saying for the record and sharing. OK. So separability of mixed states. What we want to do here is to look at a mixed state and not just test if it's separable, because you can run an entanglement witness. You can see if it violates a Bell inequality. You can see if it's positive under partial transpose. We're assuming you've tried all of those, and everything you've done shows no evidence of entanglement. So the question we're asking is, OK, so you have no evidence of entanglement. Prove it. Prove that your state is separable. You think it's separable? Show me. So as background, a state which may, at first glance, appear to be entangled isn't necessarily entangled. Mixed states, right? So take the Bell states plus and minus, right? Those are highly entangled states. If we take their mixed states, plus, plus, and minus, minus, those are entangled, sort of pure-ish entangled mixed states. They're product states. But if we take a uniform mixture of these now, which is a mixture of highly entangled states, you get this thing, which, of course, is a separable mixture as well, because I come to it, obviously, by simply taking a mixture of the 0, 0 mixed state and the 1, 1 mixed state. Yes? OK. So nothing new. Just because I write some mixed state as a sum of entangled states doesn't mean that it is an entangled state just because I wrote it as a sum of entangled states. Yeah? Yeah. No. Now, positive partial transpose is the go-to first tool when you're looking at a state to see if it's entangled or not. But it won't take you all the way there. Because if you are positive partial transpose in a state along some bipartition, and it always requires that you speak about a bipartition, right? Because you partial transpose somewhere. then it doesn't mean that this state is separable along the bipartition. And you can talk about different ways to do bipartitions. But even if it is positive partial transpose, it doesn't even give you separability along the bipartition. And what's more, if you had something that I don't know what it is, which would tell you that you're separable over a partition, just because you're separable over all possible bipartitions doesn't mean that the state is separable. In other words, you can say that the state, I can write it as a separable state where I have some state written for Alice mixed with a state which is entangled with Bob and Charlie, and I can write the state that way. I can write the state as a mixture of an entangled state with Alice and Bob mixed with a state with Charlie, and the third one as well. And I can do it those three ways independently, but I still can't write it as a state for Alice, state for Bob, state for Charlie. So separable along all bipartitions doesn't mean it's separable simultaneously. So this is a challenge. How to actually go ahead and show that a state is fully separable. That's the background. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, all right, it seems that the only way you can really prove separability is by giving a separable decomposition. You say, here's the state. You wrote it as a mixture of entangled states, but we see that there's another way to write it as a sum over separable states. And you have to find that. There's no real guidance where you might look, but do your best to find one. So there is another way. The other way is don't attack the problem head on. Just take it in pieces. So we know that there are entangled states and that there are separable states and that the separable states are much smaller than the set of entangled states. What we could do, though, is we could, instead of trying to say, you know, let's look within all the separable states, let's consider only some separable states at a time, right? So we have separable states of a given form. You have separable states in mind, which can be parameterized. And then you look at the state which you think is separable, and it looks like one thing. And then you go back and you look at your states which you know to be separable, and they have some parameterization, and you try to fit it. You say, just, you know, line by line in the matrix, basically, can I make this state fit into the parameterization which describes these separable states? If I can do that, then clearly the state is separable, and you've certified separability, right? Now, presumably the state may be separable, and you won't be able to do that. But if you can, it's separable. So this is a way to generate sufficient separability criteria, not necessary separability criteria. Here's an example. This is the example that I considered recently, which are mixtures of the Dickey states. The Dickey states are diagonal states. I feel like in the minutes that we have, I don't want to get into what they are. But generally speaking, Dickey states are entangled, right? And so what I'm writing there as this GDS, general diagonal symmetric, is a mixture of entangled states, right? On the other hand, in my library of separable states, I have a family of states which are separable, and they're also written as sums of the Dickey states, but they have particular parameters where they're basically mixtures where X is the mixing coefficient, right? Here, they sum to 1, and you can use different ones of them. And then the Ys are between 0 and 1 because they play the role of amplitudes in a symmetric state. And I'm also not going to explain why I believe these to be separable, but the idea is these are entangled, these are separable. And then the separability criterion that follows is by asking, can I make a correspondence between the state, which is maybe entangled, maybe not, and a known separable state? The idea is so simple, you kind of have to wonder why I'm here stressing it. Take a separable state, see if it fits. But that simple idea gets you a lot. Because saying, is there some separable decomposition, is a really hard, almost intractable question. Saying, does it fit this particular simple form, is a really easy question, and it gets you almost all the same ability to actually do work. So following the correspondence, you would make sort of like the Dickey states are all orthogonal, so you match it up term by term, and you end up with a system of equations, right? So you have your populations pi, and then these x and y's, which are parameters in the separable state, and you want to solve for these separable state parameters in terms of the populations. It's a system of equations. You solve them. If a solution exists, it's separable. Let me show you an in-practice example. So this is what I mean by some polynomial system of equations. You write this down for four qubits. These are your Dickey states, which have parameterizations. So the pi 5 to pi 1 are represent the weights of the entangled states. Right? And so you get this system of equations. And we try to solve the system of equations. If this system of equations is solvable for the five variables, x1, y1, x2, y2, x3, and there is no y5, then the populations mean that this particular mixture of entangled states is separable. Right? Now, I mentioned that there's no y5. And that's because there's a bit of an art to this, which is that you want to have the number of degrees of freedom in the separable state which you're saying to parameterize to should be the same as the number of degrees of freedom in the parameterization of your entangled state, if you want to do this sort of generally. So you got to watch out for that. So there is no sixth parameter, because in this case, we set it to zero. A sufficient separability criteria such as this has value. There's a quantum optics phenomenon called superradiance. Time limited, I'm not going to get into it. But it basically says that you start with a separable state, and then you time evolve into a mixture over the entangled states. Right? And so the question is, can superradiance lead to entanglement? Here's a graph of the populations. Remember, those are entangled states of a superradiating system. And so you can see, right, over here, that initially most of the populations are zero and you start out in just one of them. But then here in intermediate time, we're talking about a system which, according to this time evolution, is a mixture of the entangled states. So superradiance was thrown out as a proposal for generating entanglement. Right? You have a state which is separable. If you can get it to superradiate, you can get it to become a mixture of highly, highly, highly entangled states. And so therefore, maybe you can use this as an entanglement generation technique. But using this notion of mapping to solving the system of equations to see if it's separable, we just map the populations what did I just do? I pushed the wrong button. Into the coefficients of the separable states, right? And you watch their time evolution, and you see that they are always between 0 and 1, which means that no, entanglement cannot be used to generate, superradiance cannot be used to generate entanglement, right? So just to recap, the idea is simple. You have a state. You want to certify it's separable? Look to your library of separable states. See if it fits some form in the library. If it does, boom, you're done.
On the previous graph, at pi times, you had just the one state, pi naught.
Pi naught and pi 4 are the extremal states. And so the Dickey states, what they are is your permutations over the qubits. So the extreme first and the extreme last would be all 0 and all 1, which are separable. And so then the intermediate ones would be like W-type entanglement. The maximally excited and the ground are not. So you end up, you start in the maximally excited, which is not entangled. You end in the ground state, which is not excited. But in the middle, we were hoping to see. With this technique, you can rule out superradiance as a method for entanglement generation. And then there's this other final thought here, which is that, all right, so you've made up yourself a sufficient criterion. And maybe it works for you, great, but maybe it just happens to work for you, but you haven't captured most separable states. Can you assess the quality of the sufficient criterion that comes from looking at a particular form of separable states? Yes, here's how. You ask about the volume of states which pass this criterion, right? And it should be a pretty small number, which are certified separable. And then we can talk about, well, how many states are out there in general? And if there's no known necessary and sufficient criterion for separability, so you use a necessary criterion, like PPT. And that will capture many, many states, right? Presumably too many. Many states, not even the separable ones beyond separable, will be captured by PPT. But at least it'll give you a fractional sense of how many states you're capturing by measuring the number of states captured by your criterion as generated to a necessary criterion PPT. So I did it for the Dickey states, and you get the same number. What does that mean? It means that this technique gives you a necessary and sufficient condition. Everything gets captured. All separable states are found. You can actually prove that the PPT is, in fact, also sufficient on this family of states, because clearly its volume coincides with the sufficient criterion. And so the second idea here is that not only use your library, but use integration to assess the quality of your criterion. And integration will also prove equivalence between criterion without having to go through logical equivalence. So those are the two ideas that I wanted to share about certifying separability of mixed states. Thank you.
Questions?
Yeah.
So wouldn't this just show that PPT is necessary on all but a set of measure zero states?
Yes, exactly.
I also have some questions about the first bit.
Yeah.
With this like thing with the polynomials, were you also assuming that it was real valued? For real arguments, at least?
Yes.
How can, because you, like, you were using a matrix that had complex entries in.
Yes, but it's Hermitian. And Hermitian operators are real arguments.
Right, so that tells you the roots of it.
Yes.
But you seem to be using the like value of the characteristic polynomial as real even away from the roots. Sorry.
Oh, okay. So you're saying with the characteristic polynomial.
But it is always real coefficients. The characteristic polynomial of a Hermitian matrix is always real coefficients. You can regard it as a, if you plug in your variable x, then you, so you can get the characteristic polynomial by plugging in this variable x and taking the determinant, right? When you plug in the variable x, you still have the Hermitian matrix, depending on x. When you take the determinant of the Hermitian matrix, you still get a real number. So for any x, this way. That would be new.
Okay, that's it.
Maybe one more question.
So
you were like, basically, if you write down a like finite list of these linear inequalities, you've got like a polytope that kind of sits outside the quantum.
Right.
Have you thought at all about like finding a polytope that sits inside?
So yes, great question, yes. So I did very much, and for that I owe Roger Kolbeck a shout out, because I was here some time ago, and he had an interesting idea. So to characterize a polytope, right, you can take the extremal points and then convex combinations, right? So you could do the same thing with the quantum polytope by saying, let's take a bunch of extremal points. So you could take, for example, the point which violates the Tsurisin inequality, right? Which gets you to 2 root 2. And so to the first level, what you would have is you would be reconstructing the no-signaling polytope, which shares, the no-signaling polytope has 28 vertices, right? 16 of which are the vertices of the
Bell polytope, which are the 16 deterministic possibilities, and then the other eight, which are sort of like Bell PR boxes, right? So instead of using like PR box correlations for the other eight, use use like Cyrilson box correlations, which go up to 2 root 2, right? And then you would define a new polytope using those. But that would necessarily be a lower bound, because if the surface curves and you go from one point to the other, you're going to miss all the ones out there. So you can, and with that method, you'd be able to then say, well, let's not just consider 8 more extrema points, because if it's a curved surface, we can take more. So take like points like the ones that we have, like the 3 and the root 10, right, with the marginals, and treat those. And there's going to be a lot of these because of their symmetries. But with many, 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 many such points, you can then start connecting the points to form a circumscribed polytope, which would be a lower bound for the quantum polytope. Worth further thought. Do you want me to like put something on the board to like visualize that?
So I wanted to ask you about how to get genuine nonlinear bounds.
Yeah.
If I understood you correctly, in the parameterized, that the functional versions of the linear equalities, what you're defining is now a set of planes, each of which limits the correlations. And if I could find the envelope of that set of planes, I would then have a genuine nonlinear bound. Do you know of any general techniques for extracting envelope functions from parameterized sets of planes? This has sort of come up elsewhere for me, and I haven't seen a lot in the mathematical literature on that general problem, so I'm wondering a lot about it.
I haven't seen any literature on it. I know that Mathematica was surprisingly happy to do this. So So what I can do is I can go in and I can say, take this one here, where I give it x, and I say that this is less than this, right? And so I state that to Mathematica. And then I say, this is true for all x, where x is between 0 and 1. And then I just put on the reduce command. And it says, all right, so then you get like these 5 conditions, which are now free of x and become like roots of 8-dimensional polynomials. And it says that you have to, these have to be in between these roots and their functions. I mean, I can show you. So I don't know in general how it's done or whether it could be done for multiple, but I know that at least with just x, you just put it in, put the for all statement, tell Mathematica reduce, and it will give you a way to write it without x, which is basically the envelope.
What comes out are nonlinear inequalities for these expectation values and correlations.
Yes.
That's a good trick. Thanks.
Yeah.
In that example computation that you showed,
yes,
dependence on the angles turned out to be only in the constant of the polynomial.
Yes.
Is that generic or is that
no?
Constant?
No. Yes, it helped a lot. In general, it is much, much, much more difficult and requires a lot more steps. Each of which is sort of like a logical argument, but it's quite long. I mean, I wouldn't recommend doing it by hand. So the way in practice that I would do it is that you'd take your 4 sort of conditions or however many derivatives there are, you say that they're positive, you write everything in terms of cosine. Right? So wherever you see a sine, you switch to 1 square root of 1 minus cosine squared. And then you call cosine itself the variable which can be changed instead of theta. It makes life a lot easier. And you say that the cosine can range from 0 to 1. I don't mean cosine squared, I mean cosine, because cosine ranging from 0 to 1 is fully sufficient. And so you say, for all cosine ranging from 0 to 1, reduce. And it just reduces. So Mathematica is happy to play with it. But yes, in general, it doesn't look like that, and it's not.
Any more questions?
Yeah.
So there's some constraint on density matrices that Chris Fuchs used to talk about a lot, which ends up being equivalent to some sort of cubic equations on the edges, or the real properties that you use in the density matrix. Are you familiar with that? I forget the actual constraint. It's
trace rho cubed equal to 1?
Trace rho cubed equal to 1. Okay, and if you translate that into, if you parameterize your density matrix with real numbers, then you'll get a cubic equation.
Trace rho cubed being 1.
Yeah. That's a constraint on the pure states.
And then your Cantabile, okay.
And then the convex completion of that space will give you the whole space.
I always thought it was trace rho cubed as trace rho squared. Yeah.
But for the pure states, it's the same. Trace rho squared is 1.
Yeah. The point is to parameterize the extreme
part of
the set.
Yes.
And then.
Okay, I'm with you. Uh-huh.
So in that space, the way of characterizing quantum states, at least, is with these cubic equations. Is there any reason to think that you'd get some corresponding cubic equations in the space that you're trying to characterize?
I don't see a connection because that is specifically arguing about the states, and this is very much state independent. I guess they're both sort of for all states, but
this is. I don't see a connection. I'm just wondering if there's a connection between characterizing the shape of your state space and characterizing your eight-dimensional space here.
So state space is a term that can mean different things to different people. There's the space of the correlations, right? Which is a measurement on the these. And then there's this space, which would be like the set of elements which would give you a positive semi-definite operator. But one is a measurement on probabilities, the other is a measurement on, you know, elements.
Do you anticipate being able to combine, so this sort of trick with starting with linear inequalities and getting non-linear inequalities, just someday able to say, here is the precise boundary of the ellipsoid in the eight-dimensional cases?
Well, good question. If we consider the general question, which was written in terms of C1 through C8, right? So, you can obviously multiply one or divide by all of them trivially. So essentially there are 7 free parameters there which are of interest. If someone could, with 7 free parameters, get such a nonlinear bound, I'm doing it with 1, right? X is the only thing I leave as non-numeric. But if you could do it with 7 of them, independently, you would necessarily have a complete characterization of the quantum ellipse. That would do the trick.
But maybe you could do it with, various different 1 parameter or, many different 2 parameter inequalities. And the trick would be proving that that was somehow
that
capturing
would be
just the bound, like maybe by showing it's both the lower and upper bound or something like that.
Ooh. I like. Very nice. Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank Ellie again.
Thank you.